Welcome to the East County Magazine Live Radio Show, the voice of East County, bringing you the hottest news and coolest events from the communities of San Diego's East County. We're your community radio, representing the public interest, not special interests. Broadcasting from the heart of East County in Descanso with your host, Miriam Raftery.
Now, straight from the headlines, we bring you the latest top newsmakers.
This is Miriam Raftery with the East County Magazine Show on KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, recording at the San Diego Performance Academy. My guest today is Chris Lavin, and Chris is the editor and the owner of La Mesa Today, one of La Mesa's newspapers.
We like to think we're the best, most immediate source for local news in the city of La Mesa.
Yeah, definitely. You're covering what's happening at every city council meeting, all the different commissions and things, and doing a very good job of covering the La Mesa political scene as well as a lot of other things in La Mesa, which happens to be my hometown. So welcome to the show, Chris.
Well, I hope you're a reader.
Absolutely. I'd like to start by asking you to tell our listeners a little bit about La Mesa Today. What made you decide to found the newspaper?
Sure. I was the senior editor of the San Diego Union Tribune for 10 years. And when David Copley sold the paper and I left there, I have always, in my 30-year newspaper career, I'd always liked the kind of intimate connection I had in journalism when I started in a small town in upstate New York, in the Finger Lakes, Geneva, New York. I thought that it would be, in the new media days, a good thing for a community to have some ownership of its own information, rather than having its information gathered up by a large downtown organization with presses and then sold back to the people that it came from. I thought it would be better to just use the new media to create a journalistically sound place with no anonymity for people to share events and information, and that I could, on the side of my life, keep good journalism in La Mesa.
Now, your paper is entirely online, is that?
It is. We've considered doing a sort of weekly print supplement, but the costs of doing some of that can diminish the quality of what you're doing. Many of the print publications that still exist for places like La Mesa are really, in my view, Pyrrhic victories. They exist, but they don't spend anything on journalism.
That's true, and you also lose the immediacy with the internet. You can report on things when they're happening. For instance, if there's a police chase and they're looking for a suspect, you get the information out there right away for your readers.
We live in a cell phone world.
That's true.
And the media is needing to supply that first and then do more depth in other forms later.
Print is a
luxury.
Well, I think La Mesa is fortunate to have a newspaper. Sadly, many towns across East County and all of America today don't have one at all. So La Mesa, in a lot of ways, is sort of like Mayberry. It's been likened to that. It's America's small town, historic town, goes back 100 years. But I would like to ask you first, Chris, if you can give us kind of a big picture of how La Mesa is doing today. What are some of the big issues there? And how is the city faring fiscally in times that have been certainly troubling for many cities across America?
Sure. One of the reasons I live in La Mesa and chose it was that I liked the scale and scope of the community. It's tucked into Mount Helix, and it has the kind of hometown feel that I liked growing up in Geneva, New York. And I thought, what a great place, live in the heavenly place like San Diego and still have the intimacy of a small town. However, in the macro sense, when you look at a town like La Mesa, it really is tucked in as a bedroom community on the side of a much bigger city of San Diego. And the issues, in my view, that face it are more macroeconomic than they are microcultural. We all know we like Mayberry, but how do you keep it that way in a world in which there's only 50,000, 60,000 people in La Mesa?
Nine square miles
and so much economic activity that can generate only so much sales tax, only so much property tax, and the cost of running independent fire and police departments and maintaining the quality of housing stock and enforcing building codes is not inexpensive. And so there's a dynamic there for a little town like La Mesa, particularly tucked in into a region that's growing madly. The growth slowed down a little bit after the economic downturn, but for the most part, La Mesa is smack dab in the middle of what is continuing over the long run of 100 years to be a massive population growth, and the ability to control and maintain the quality of life. I often say to people, if you drive down University Avenue from the city of San Diego, when you get to La Mesa, you know you're in La Mesa. It's changed. Mm-hmm. And it's changed for all the reasons that a well-run city has managed to keep its property rules, its signage rules, a variety of things in place.
Yeah.
That takes staffing, takes tax support, takes a political will.
Yeah, well, and the citizens, too, have been willing to support their city. They've been willing to pass, say, a sales tax increase to fund things like the new library and the new fire station.
They've staved off some of the long-term economic trends for mm-hmm. small towns in America by doing some of that, and it's in California where there's more economic activity and affluence. But in general, I would describe La Mesa's financial situation as fragile. They will have spent the last 2 years in deficit spending, using reserves to close the gap between their costs of running the city and the revenues they bring in. They hope to turn that around.
Right.
But even the projections of turning around still show two lines fighting
right.
Each other pretty precariously.
And we've seen more and more contention in recent years forming up within the city council, and in some cases between council members and the mayor, despite the fact that at least three of them on there have served together for many, many, many years. What do you see as driving that, Chris? What are the dynamics at play here that are fostering so much contention in recent years?
Well, you know, Mayberry is a small town, and I bet when the cameras were turned off, the sheriff and the people in Mayberry didn't get along quite as nicely as they did on the show. When you look at a town like La Mesa, say there's 60,000 people, maybe 25,000 of them are under 18, and you start getting down to the size of the actual politically engaged and informed, it's small. Mm-hmm. And then you add to that the number of people who are fully engaged in it, that's smaller. And then the number of people who run for office, that's not only smaller, but it's been the same group of people for roughly the last 20 years with
True.
Few changes. So mm-hmm. there's a personality dynamic. I think like family members, they get tired of each other and war wounds and battles have a personal dynamic to it. But also there's the overall macro responsibilities of running a city like this. How do you pay the policemen? How do you pay the firemen?
Now, we mentioned that many of these members have served together for a long time, but that's going to be changing, it appears. We have Councilman Ewan recently announced that he is stepping down and will not run again, which opens up a seat on the council. We have Councilman Mark Rapostathis, who's just come out and announced that he's going to challenge Mayor Madrid for the mayoral seat. And what that means is win or lose, it opens up a seat on the council. So actually, there's two open seats for the first time in quite a long time.
Sure, it's a time. It's clearly a time for, in this city's standards of true rapid change, which it can be a good thing, could also be a bad thing. Stability and strength at difficult times are needed. You're definitely going to have two new council people mm-hmm. and perhaps a new mayor.
So maybe we ought to look at those races separately a little bit. What do you see as shaping up to be some of the hot issues in the mayoral race, for starters?
To me, as watching as an observer, it'll be a question about whether things go beyond the personal animus that's grown up between a long-serving mayor and some of his council people over the last...
Yeah, Mayor Madrid's been around for, what,
right.
25 years, I think right. it is, as mayor, and many years before that on the council.
The mayor is a pugnacious sort of character who will has no problems pointing out what he sees as the failures of others.
Yeah.
And Mark Rapostathis is a school teacher who teaches second and third graders and coaches people in theater. Mm-hmm. I don't expect to see him engaging in or even responding in some cases to any sort of attack kind
right.
of media.
But what does he stand for?
But,
what are some of the key issues
that
he wants?
I think that's a good question. I would say that as an observer, I've sat through more meetings than probably any person in La Mesa in the mm-hmm. last 3 years, that you can say what the mayor stands for. That's his advantage.
Right.
It's hard to say what his opponents stand for other than they don't like him.
Yeah,
it's been sort of a personal thing. I guess Ernie Ewan, I would say, stood for trying to adhere to a more rigid form of the city manager form of government, keeping the mayor from acting like a lead executive. He's really just one of five council members in a weak mayor form of government that they have. So I can't say. I think that's what this race will define.
Yeah, hopefully there'll be debates coming up, I would hope.
I think they'll debate frequently, and it's my hope as a citizen that the issues, that there are the significant issues of how you're going to manage and pay for the city, what you're going to do with police and fire salaries. Mm-hmm. They haven't given raises in many years. Yeah. There's also a contingent in La Mesa.
Now, we had Councilwoman Alicio on the show this week, and she was actually saying that they should be cutting, you know, the pension liability and making employees pay more out of their pocket for medical and so forth, even though they haven't had raises in many years.
Yeah, I think that it could be a healthy debate to get at the facts behind some of those assumptions on what the unions have managed to arrange as their situation in La Mesa and mm-hmm. what the city is actually paying for its services.
Yeah.
It's been very easy for politicians to yell at unions for having too big a pension, but the politicians were the ones who negotiated those pensions over the last 20 and 30 years.
Yeah, and then there's always the question of, is there anything more that could be done to bring in revenues, tourism, whatever it might be, selling surplus property or something?
Also, La Mesa has a unique opportunity, probably of any West Coast city of its size.
In what sense?
That it has almost 10 acres of open land smack dab in the middle of its city. They don't look at it. People don't look at it like that. But if you look at the land that is slated for the Park Station project, and you look at the city parking lots, and then you look at the former city police station land, all running along Spring Street, you actually have a unique ability to do something thoughtful.
Interesting idea.
In a built-out
certainly
city.
Yeah, the Park Station is a multi-story, I think it was at one point 18, now they've backed it down to maybe 11-story project that's proposed. But are you saying maybe there's other types of uses that could or should be considered for that land, Chris?
I would hope that an election that deals with the opportunity of city-owned land that races mm-hmm. right through the middle of the city and the need for more revenue and the need that at least that discussion and debate happens.
Yeah.
That it's easy to say we don't want 18-story buildings in La Mesa. Almost everybody would say that in the town.
Well, it's interesting, though. There is, I know one concern I've heard some people voice is that some of the candidates coming forward for the council come from a strong development background. Certainly, Bill Baber, I believe, represented the Contractors Association.
Bill Baber's worked with everybody.
Yeah, Mary England was openly advocating for the high-rise project. She's the president of the La Mesa Chamber of Commerce. So there has been some concern that you could perhaps see a shift toward a more pro-development-oriented council, perhaps less concerned possibly with maintaining, you know, the historic character of the village and so forth. What do you think?
Well, it's going to be, as I said, that's at the heart of the balance that it's going to take in a small town. You need revenue in order to pay to keep an independent police department and independent firefighters, other services, keeping the streets up. It's rather, local government's very basic. Keep the lights on, the streets walking, the sewers working.
Yeah.
In La Mesa, I think it's a little bit interesting. There's a sort of ideological discussions about big government politics.
Mm-hmm.
It's a little harder for me as knowing that basically it's the job of cleaning the streets and and but the revenue questions. How do you say to a city like La Mesa, yeah, I know 8 stories is probably higher than we want, but that project's going to generate
so much money,
$2 million million dollars in revenue that we're going to be able to use to do other things in the city. That's a kind of mature debate that has to happen in a small town people know the give and take.
Sure. What about the Grossmont Center property? The lease on that is coming due next year. What have you heard, Chris, about any potential changes in the way that that piece of land is used? And are there options that could possibly generate more revenue for the city there?
I think there's potential for more revenue, and there's probably some potential for less. If you look at properties like that around the country that have been redeveloped, the idea of the old suburban mall surrounded by parking and just plain retail has given way to mixed use.
Yeah.
And in fact, they've developed, actually Sandag has developed with the city, a 3D projection of what something like Grossmont Center could be with residential mixed with retail. You can find that on our website if you search for
it
on La Mesa Today. That's an unknown.
Yeah.
But I can tell you that the future economic generation of coming from that property is crucial to the city of La Mesa. It's the sales tax that's generated there, and the property taxes keeps the city afloat. Mm-hmm. So anything that changes, it's easy to see what's been done around the country. It's harder to project exactly what the impact on a city like La Mesa would be when they're done.
Yeah, very important issue.
You're listening to East County Magazine Show on KNSJ 89.1 FM, Descanso.
Chris Lavin is the editor and the owner of La Mesa Today. Now, Chris, have you heard any additional names? I mentioned a couple of them that I've heard. Who else have you heard putting their name into the hat or being bandied about as possible candidates for these council races? Or for that matter, is there anybody else thinking of taking a run for mayor?
You know, I tend to deal with facts in this area. A lot of people talk. I see who files their papers, and then I see who files their reports on fundraising.
True. When is the filing deadline? If our listeners out there want to throw their hats in the ring, when is the last day they
actually
can file?
I don't know that off the top of my head. August sometime, probably.
Yeah.
And even later, if an
incumbent chooses not to run.
And so people have said they're running before and pulled papers. Others have not. So I do know that I have been told directly by Bill Baber, the school board member and local political operative,
correct,
that he's running.
Yes.
And I've heard rumors of others, but, you know, there's no need to deal in rumors. We can see what people are actually going to do.
We'll wait until August and see who actually comes through with the papers.
Right.
Now, Chris, you also have a very lively, interactive discussion going on your site because of the ability on the internet that you didn't have with the old print version of the UT.
Sure.
How have you handled the whole issue of fostering discussion versus trying to keep things, you know, civil and honest in these online discussion boards? What's your policy on that?
Well, one of the great joys of being a sole proprietor with a largely non-commercial news operation is that I don't need to give in to the race for eyeballs. There was an operation the AOL ran for a while. The remnants of it may still be around, called Patch.
Yeah.
And they just wanted eyeballs at any cost, so they would let anyone anonymously post anything to generate.
Yeah, all kinds of rants on
there. Right, to generate things. We try and limit anonymity on our site. In fact, when people apply for membership, it's free, but we do check out to make sure that they're real, they're local, and I can find some sign that they're not a made-up person. Once in a while, somebody sneaks through, but for the most part, the conversation on our site is not as voluminous as others, but they're more thoughtful. Because
it's quality, not quantity.
Fewer but better comments is what we want. Mm-hmm. We recently ran a survey. It was interesting that we have put out to our membership a survey of local issues and preferences for political candidates, and it drew more than 400 responses in a short period. Mm-hmm. And it revealed more than, I think, 300 comments came from people.
Oh, wow.
It was like a town hall meeting, actually, but more thoughtful than a town hall meeting, because people sat in their homes and thought about what they wanted to say said it. And I published those comments as well. And it was, I think, in some ways far more useful for the city to gauge what they needed to be doing than their own town hall meetings. But
yeah, actually, you can learn in general on some of these online sites. Sometimes you learn as much from the comments as you can from the original story. Not that the original stories aren't wonderful, but you begin to get a sort of a pulse of what people are thinking out there, perhaps.
Yeah, and we keep it by limiting anonymity as much as we can.
That brings up an interesting point. You've had a little bit of controversy there in the last week or so, where you revealed to your readers that actually Councilwoman Christine Alicio had posted some comments under a pseudonym that she later said was her daughter's pseudonym. Can you fill us in on the background of that? She was on our show, and she had some unflattering remarks to say about how the whole thing was handled. We'd love to hear your side of the story on that, Chris.
Oh, sure. Miss Alicio has been a longtime public servant, worked on the Planning Commission for years, and did a good job for the city. So I hold her no disrespect. I do think that in moving into an elected position, which she did recently, she's learning the difference between being a volunteer appointed and an elected person. But essentially, she has a lovely daughter who I've known through the theater groups for years. High schooler, who was several months ago was posting anonymously under a name.
Now, is that allowed for minors on your site?
Anybody over the age of 13 can join, and she was over that. And there's not a problem, but she posted under a false name and managed to get through our checking system several months ago. I discovered it wrote her a personal note and asked her not to do it again. And she continued to try and post under that anonymous name, and I stopped receiving them. That stopped. Fast forward a few weeks later, and then suddenly there's a new person posting under the name of Dino Cowell and mm-hmm. making a lot of sort of angry accusations about some of the local politicians. But in politics, we have a pretty strong stomach for comments. Mm-hmm. But we did a double check when we couldn't figure out who this person was from some of the comments, reflected some knowledge of the city, and we said, well, who is this person? Nobody seemed to know. We did a double check and found out, well, it was in fact not a real person. But we frankly discovered that when Christine Alessio posted under that name.
Councilwoman
posted under that name. The comments were posted. She's a public official, and several of our readers actually contacted us to say, did you notice that she identified herself in the comment, but it came under this Dino Cowell name? Now we know who Dino Cowell is.
Yeah.
Well, I didn't know that it was her.
She claimed she was logged in accidentally.
She did.
No,
she logged in.
Her daughter was logged in.
She says that it was her daughter's login. So I called her, and she said identified her daughter as the person who was doing the name posting under Dino.
And then she got mad and said, you outed her daughter.
She identified her daughter to me, and I asked her if she knew that just a month before I had gone talked to her daughter about not posting. She said yes, but I can't keep my daughter from posting anonymously. And then later she became...
So she's basically encouraging her daughter to not discouraging her from violating your rules.
Yeah, she didn't...
Interesting.
She may not have been aware. I don't know what she was aware of herself. She mm-hmm. posts... Ms. Alessio has been an active member of the site and generally posts under her own name, and I don't begrudge her that. But I needed to respond to readers who were thinking that Ms. Alessio was the one who had published all these previous comments. Some of them were quite harsh about the mayor and others.
Yeah, now she is one of the people who's behind the term limits measure, trying to put a term limits initiative on the ballot. I'm curious what your readers are saying about that, what your take is on maybe the merits of the initiative, but also whether you think this is going to qualify or whether you think La Mesa voters are going to approve that or not.
I would expect, I think term limits are generally supported around the country. They tend to be successful when they get there. I don't have a dog in that hunt. Mm-hmm. It's interesting that they've made it a sort of Art Madrid's been serving too long. We need term limits here.
Yeah, they keep claiming it's not about him, and yet.
Well, if you talk to the people collecting the signatures, they'd say we got to get rid of Art Madrid.
Yeah, I was told that. Yeah, yeah. when I was asked to sign at a mall.
That's part of the La Mesa. There's a group of La Mesa who like to take on big macro political issues and talk about Jean Paul Sartre and quote Jefferson and all that stuff. And I think that's part of it. Part of the character of the town. Mm-hmm. I think people can vote. It'll make no difference to these elected officials because if it passes, they still have 12 more years and Art's 80. And
right.
I think that Ruth Sterling is 82 or so. And I don't believe either of them. And Art has said to me that this would be his last run.
Ah.
Anyway.
Okay.
So.
Very interesting.
Yeah. It's part of the tensions, though, is that Ms. Alessio is closely aligned with a group of men in town who have been identifying Art as somebody they don't want to see remain
in
office.
Right, and she is the new voice on the council, and a lot of this contention has kind of come to a head since her election, I think.
Sure, but that's, that's politics.
Sure.
It's rough and tumble. And
yeah, never a dull moment.
No, but if you post something online, inadvertently even, your political opponents for an elected official will jump on it.
Yeah, definitely.
It wasn't the media jumping on it, and I think that that's part of the learning process for a new elected official. The media is the media. Mm-hmm. We're middlemen in a debate out there.
Is there anything else, Chris, that I haven't asked you about that's important going on in La Mesa right now that you think our listeners might like to hear about?
I think that if you want to be a clear-eyed optimist or sort of rosy-colored glasses person, they're going to be rebuilding the old main drag of the town. Mm. And in my experience, if anyone's ever read Jane Jacobs' The Origins of Cities and things like that, it's the one thing the city can do to really elevate a city is to build better streets.
Yes.
It raises the rents around, tends to raise rents, increases the quality of the stores that are there, and that's going to be happening in the next year. That's a good thing for the city. And they have that 8 acres, 10 acres of land that are open.
That's true.
New things, new people. But I do think that this election needs to keep its eye on protecting the city's ability to keep that distinction between surrounding cities that have that struggled and La Mesa that is better, and that's going to be more of a challenge for them going forward financially.
Definitely. La Mesa, of course, just celebrated its centennial year last year, and it's going to be very interesting, I think, to see what happens over the next 100 years. Don't you wish you could be here, travel through time, Chris, in 100 years and see what La Mesa is like?
I'll enjoy my time here. let others take it on after that. You'll go forward. But, I encourage people to join LaMesaToday.com. It's free. And as I said, we try and keep it civil. And we are really just motivated by trying to help the town as long as we can maintain this sort of media.
Well, there you go. And again, I think La Mesa is very fortunate to actually have an editor who cares about these issues and educating the public, unlike so many towns across our region that just don't really have a local press anymore.
Yeah, the people own the information. They need to be good stewards of it.
There you go. Well, Chris, thank you very much for joining us here today on the East County Magazine Show on KNSJ.
Thank you, Mary.
This is East County Magazine's Tribal Beat, bringing you news for and about our region's Native American communities. Two Native American families have filed a lawsuit alleging that a contractor for the Jamul Indians desecrated human remains during construction of a casino at the Jamul Indian Village. The families are asking for an injunction to halt construction. Plaintiffs contend that a contractor for the tribe, C.W. Driver, dug up the family's remains from the historical cemetery at the casino site and dumped the human remains, with Caltrans permission, on the state's construction site for a new freeway interchange in Otay. Superior Court Judge Prager heard arguments on Thursday. The judge has given Caltrans until Friday, April 19th, to respond and set an emergency hearing for April 22nd on the request for injunctive relief. The suit was filed on behalf of Walter P. Rosales, Karen Toggery, and the estates of several of their family members. The families had opposed the casino and had their homes bulldozed by the tribe to make way for the casino. A previous suit filed by the families against the Jamul tribe was dismissed in federal court. The tribe was not sued in the current lawsuit. Tribal Chairman Raymond Hunter has reportedly said that the Jamul tribe has no record of remains moved illegally, adding, "Our tribe reveres and honors our ancestors and the passing of all tribal members." Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Leon Thompson.
Now it's time for the Green Scene Report, highlighting energy, environmental, and sustainability issues in our community.
This is Rebecca Williamson with a report on solar roadways. In 2012, we reported on a potentially promising new technology to build roadways out of glass panels capable of producing solar power. Now, Scott Broussard at the Solar Roadways newsletter has provided an update on a prototype parking lot that has now been installed. Photos show the hexagonal-shaped green-tinted panels just outside the inventor's lab. The design has been tested in university engineering labs for traction, strength, and toughness. Broussard states the results were far beyond our wildest hopes. Installing the solar parking lot during a cold Idaho winter has also provided a chance to test out heaters that melt snow and ice off the panels, which were warm and dry to the touch. According to Broussard, we're collecting solar energy from the parking lot, and it is exciting to see the amount climb every day as the sun rises higher on the horizon with each day of spring, he added. The company's hometown of Sandpoint, Idaho, has applied for a grant to install solar roads and sidewalks, and while more fine-tuning is planned to improve energy harvesting for maximum efficiency, Broussard says it's time to gear up for manufacturing, and he's hired a team of engineers to help streamline the process. To finance its efforts, Solar Roadways is launching a crowdsourcing funding drive through an Indiegogo campaign on April 22nd, Earth Day.
The East County Magazine Show on KNSJ Radio is produced by the nonprofit Heartland Coalition. We're your community news. We reflect your interest, not special interest. You can get involved by volunteering
Get trained to be a citizen journalist and support East County Magazine at www.eastcountymagazine.org. And you can send your news tips and story ideas to editor@eastcountymagazine.org.
You're listening to East County Magazine Show on KNSJ 89.1 FM, Descanso.
This is Miriam Raftery with an education report. A public hearing on proposed unification of the Alpine Union School District will be held in Alpine on April 29th at 6 p.m. in the Alpine Elementary School Auditorium. The hearing will be conducted by the San Diego County Board of Education. Unification would shift Alpine families out of the Grossmont Union High School District and into an Alpine Union School District that would be expanded to include students through 12th grade. Unification is sought by many Alpine parents after the Grossmont Board repeatedly failed to build the long-promised high school, despite two bond measures for the purpose and a grand jury admonishment of the board. These parents hope the Alpine District will ultimately be able to build a high school for Alpine students. At the meeting on April 29th, the county board will hear a presentation from the petitioners, followed by testimony from the school districts affected, and then from individuals. Any materials for the board's review should be submitted 72 hours in advance. You can get more information at the County Board of Education's website or in East County Magazine's education section at www.eastcountymagazine.org.
This is Ben Martin with a sports report about some local athletes who are making a big splash. Two members of the San Diego Sea Stars synchronized swimming team have just earned ninth place in the duet event at the U.S. National Championships. The team has its roots in East County and practices each week at San Miguel High School in Spring Valley. Held in Arizona from April 8th to the 11th, the event features the top synchronized swimmers in the U.S. The routine of Ainsley Douglas and Alexander Suarez beat 25 duets from around the country to place ninth in the 13 to 15 age group during the competition. Next up for the club is the age group regionals on May 17th in San Diego. The San Diego Sea Stars will be entering a number of routines in several age group categories starting as young as 11 years old. Synchronized swimming requires a unique combination of strength, agility, endurance, flexibility, and speed. The San Diego Sea Stars synchronized swimming team practices 3 to 6 hours per day, 4 days per week at the Mount Miguel High School pool. Elite-level synchronized swimmers typically practice 8 hours per day, 6 days per week. You can also join the San Diego Sea Stars synchronized swimming team on May 3rd from 10 a.m. to 12 noon at Mount Miguel High School and be part of the USA Cinco de Mayo. This is a free opportunity for kids of all ages to learn about, see, and try synchronized swimming, and above all, have fun. Everyone who attends gets the chance to be a synchronized swimmer for the day.
Oh, yeah.
The Lakeside skateboarding community has something to be excited about this spring as construction on the brand new Lakeside Skate Park is almost complete. The project has been a community-based effort started in 2009 to give kids a clean and positive environment where they can perfect their board skills without getting chased away by security guards and angry residents. The new facility has a large area committed to the sport with terrain that rivals some of the best skate parks in the country. Rails, ledges, vert elements, and an empty pool are just a few of the new features that will be available for kids to ride. Many local businesses and private donors have come together to fund the project, including a major sponsorship from the Tony Hawk Foundation. Tony was seen in the park last week, which caused quite a buzz as he skated and signed boards and t-shirts for the kids. The skate park will open on April 25th at 3 p.m. with a ribbon-cutting ceremony. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Ed Barrena.
La Mesa's City Council voted down a proposal by Mayor Art Madrid that would have banned council members from using their cell phones during public meetings, including closed sessions. Mayor Madrid argued that since members of the public in the audience are asked to silence their cell phones, council members should too. Madrid said it's a sign of disrespect for council members to have a double standard that requires audience members to leave the room if they want to speak on their phones, while allowing council members to talk or text as they please. But council members won out, voting to keep the double standard.
Council members said they do silence the ringer on their phones, but want to keep receiving and sending text messages during meetings. Councilman Ernie Ewan said he has received alerts from the police department and likes to get messages from his wife when she's traveling. He's also received notices of a relative's death via his cell phone during a meeting, he said. Councilwoman Christine Alicio indicated she uses her cell phone to take notes and has texted her teenage daughter during meetings. La Mesa resident Patrick Dean asked the city attorney if cell phone messages made during meetings would be required to be disclosed as public records. The attorney said that personal messages would be exempt, but if a communication involved city business, it could be disclosable under the Brown Act, California's open meeting law. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Miriam Raftery.
Attention, motorist. April is Distracted Driving Awareness Month. 5 seconds is the average time your eyes are off the road while texting. While traveling at 55 miles per hour, that's enough time to cover the length of a football field blindfolded. A driver who texts or uses a handheld cell phone is 4 times more likely to get into crashes serious enough to injure themselves or cause death, according to the California Office of Traffic Safety. If that's not enough to keep your hands on the wheel, the Sheriff's Department is putting drivers on notice. The department is having a zero-tolerance policy toward drivers using handheld cell phones during National Distracted Driving Awareness Month in April. If you are caught violating California's cell phone laws, you will be cited and face a minimum fine of $161 plus court fees. Any further violations will cost you even more. Deputies will also be conducting special distracted driving enforcement patrols across the county. The next enforcement patrol will be held on Tuesday, April 22nd. We take the issue of distracted driving very seriously, said Sheriff Bill Gore. Sheriff's deputies are always on the lookout for drivers who are texting or using handheld phones to prevent accidents that could seriously hurt people. New teenage drivers can learn all about the responsible driving by taking a Start Smart class offered by the Sheriff's Department. The 2-hour class features teens all about driver safety, including not texting and driving. If you want more information, visit www.sdsheriff.net. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Rebecca Williamson.
This is Janice Russell, host of People Power, profiling people and organizations making a positive difference in our community and our world. Today, I am here with Tad Parzan, the executive director of the City Heights Partnership for Children. Your goal has been that young people emerge as adults with the skills to succeed in college or career and enter adulthood as productive members of the community, and you have done this through collective impact. How does this work, and who have you partnered up with?
Well, thanks for having me. Janice, it's nice to see you, and it's nice to be here. So we've partnered with pretty much every sector that impacts the lives of children, whether it's schools or government or law enforcement or philanthropy or nonprofit, parents themselves and even children themselves, as well as health agencies, social service agencies, and the business community. So this is all about getting all of those stakeholders in youth outcomes, getting them all aligned around the very important things, those critical milestones, and what we need to do to get kids to those milestones. And the milestones we use are readiness for kindergarten, third grade literacy, eighth grade math and language proficiency, and graduation from high school with real skills to succeed, not just a piece of paper. So we're very excited moving forward, and it's already impacting children's lives on the ground.
Very good. And how successful has this collective impact process been?
Well, again, on the ground, we're already seeing fabulous results. For example, 500 kids getting glasses free of charge on the school site, never actually having to leave school. to get vision care, get the primary exam, secondary exam, and then glasses if they need it. So those are kids, and we all know, we all remember that kid who wasn't paying attention in school and fell behind, and then we found out later, oh, it was really because he or she had a vision problem, but by the time it got discovered, it was too late. Another example would be hundreds of parents getting training in how to get your child ready for kindergarten so that when they get there, they have the beginnings of literacy skills, the beginnings of number understanding. They understand how to work in a group a little more. They're familiar with books a little bit more. And we're hearing from teachers and principals and parents that there's a crop of kindergartners coming into school this year that are way more prepared, way more engaged, and parents are more engaged.
Very good. Your website mentions that you are first focused on reaching the Hoover High School cluster, which consists of one high school, two middle schools, and 10 elementary schools. What were the needs there, and how have you worked to improve them?
So City Heights, and in particular the area where Hoover sits, is the vulnerable youth epicenter of the region. It is the most youth-dense place in all of San Diego County, and there's a lot of low-income families there, some with generational poverty, some immigrants who are struggling to make their way in America. So all of the issues that come with that kind of community, whether it's access to health or access to health care or accessing health care and having the understanding of what wellness visits are and how do you get access to that care. Vision care would be another example. Family stability would be another example. Family income stability would be another example. And then there's the educational factors that we want to support schools in a way that we've not done in the past. It really takes more than just schools to educate children. It takes a 360-degree support set in order to get a child, for example, to where you are today. That really took more than just school. That took family, that took neighborhood, that took community, that took healthcare, et cetera. So we really are trying to piece together that holistic approach to supporting every child every step of the way from cradle to college or career.
Have you since expanded to any other schools?
We're about to start in Vista. The Vista Unified School District and the City of Vista have approached us about bringing the Partnership for Children to Vista, and that will be launching probably May or June. So we're open to any community. We're open to serving in any community that wants us and is ready. We're very careful not to just go into a community and say, hey, we're here to fix anything. We're not here to fix anything. We're here to help build the civic infrastructure with you, our partners, with the community as a partner, hearing the community voice and getting the technical expertise and resources from the public and private sector. Although it's important to note that we're not asking for more public money to be spent. We think we can do so much more with the public resources that are already there, just allocating more strategically aligned, and managing to outcomes so that we, as a community, can be proud that we brought our children to readiness for kindergarten and third grade literacy and so on. It's really about coming together as a community and doing the most with what we have. I mean, regardless of whether you're on the left side of the political spectrum or the right side, on the left they might call it takes a village to raise a child. On the right they might say that it's 1,000 points of light. Well, that those 1,000 points of light are much stronger if they're focused as a beam of light to get to particular results that we know are going to build a thriving neighborhood fabric.
Could this work in somewhere like El Cajon, where there's the highest poverty level?
Well, it could definitely work. What we're seeing all over the country, in some places that are more like El Cajon, in some places are more like City Heights, in some places are more like Vista, in some places are more like Southeast San Diego, this framework, we don't really call it a model, we call it a framework because it's really like a frame of a house that each community can build on and create the house and the infrastructure that works well for them. So it's really about understanding the needs of that specific community rather than coming in with a preconceived notion of what will work.
Your website also mentions that the City Heights residents, many of whom are immigrants or refugees, have been stepping up to serve as catalysts for positive changes in the community, and they have been working closely with a group of community-based organizations. Can you describe that in more detail for us?
Oh, I'd be happy to. In fact, you can't see it over the podcast or the radio, but the big smile on my face will tell you how excited I am about it. So, for example, when we asked kindergarten teachers, what percentage of kids do they see each fall who are really prepared to succeed in kindergarten. The percentage was shockingly low. I mean, so low that it's just intolerable and unacceptable that in 21st century America that would happen anywhere, let alone right here in what we call America's finest city. So we asked what it would take to get kids to a place of deeper readiness. And clearly, that's something that has to happen before they get to school. So that's really in the preschools and in the family settings. So we got together with a number of nonprofits who work in early childhood literacy and schools, asked what they had, what we need to do. And then we engaged a group of parents that we call promotores. So these are people from the community who then receive a toolkit that the nonprofits and the families devised together that's translated in, it's in English, but it's translated in Spanish, Vietnamese, and Somali. Then the promotores or cultural brokers, if you will, or community brokers receive training in how to use those toolkits. And these are exercises and activities, everyday activities that help your kid get ready for school, whether it's a letter of the day, a color of the day, a folding exercise to show shapes and triangles and squares. Regardless of what it is, there are all kinds of things that can happen in the home at no cost that will help build readiness. So 20 parents received this training that was provided by a nonprofit. Again, this is not about new resources. This is making more of what out of what we have. So they received the training, and then they each trained 5 to 10 other families. So now you've got this pebble in the pond effect where you got the ripples going out. These 20 parents became 200 parents, becomes 400, 500, and 1,000. And eventually you get this deep and rich community-owned movement where parents are driving kindergarten readiness in a way that we've never seen before.
Oh, wow. That's really great. So what can the public do to help? And are there any volunteer opportunities available?
Well, there are always volunteer opportunities available. Schools and children all need help, and volunteerism is critical. Volunteerism comes in many forms. Some is in supporting a school through whether it's facilities help or cleanup help or receiving training so you can adequately support literacy. The days of going to school and volunteering to read to children are somewhat in the past because we really need those to be important instructional minutes. So there are a couple things that I would ask community members to do is, one, we've got to make this a movement. If we want to call ourselves in San Diego America's finest city, then we need to act like it. And we need to act like it by supporting our children from cradle to college or career, because that's what's going to build the fabric of our community and our neighborhood and our economy. You got businesses who are talking about they don't have the workforce pipeline that they need, and the economy is not robust enough. Well, if we have young people who are trained to do the jobs that are here, then businesses won't have to go elsewhere. So helping schools to devise relevance and curriculum that will lead to workforce readiness, supporting agencies that help build youth character and preparedness and support children, such as mentoring programs. One of our best partners, Reality Changers, Chris Yanoff, does a wonderful job there with our wonderful other community partners like Words Alive and Community Housing Works. And I've started this list, and there are so many, I'll never name them all. But volunteering in those agencies, getting real training so that you can really make an impact rather than just showing up to help a little bit. But showing up to help is always good. I mean, there are schools that need help both in terms of cleanups, in terms of painting, communities that need cleanups, communities that need ownership. One concrete example would be like forming a walking school bus. So kids in the neighborhood know that the community is behind them getting to school. The walking school bus is a wonderful example of a community getting behind kids in a way that doesn't require special training. It just requires organization, letting kids know and letting the school know that the community, the neighborhood, the parents, the grandparents, the aunts, the uncles, are all, the businesses are all behind kids getting to school safely, getting to school prepared, and really making the most of their lives.
Is there anything else that you'd like to share about this program with the listeners?
I wish I could look each and every one of them in the eye and thank them for their support in terms of getting our children ready to be productive citizens and community members. I wish that they could see the light in those children's eyes as they start to turn the corner from not understanding that they have a real shot, that they have a real chance to succeed in San Diego or wherever they choose to go. that's really what I would love for people to see, like I see every day, is that instant light in a child's eye when they first understand I can really be something and I'm going to.
Thank you, Tad.
Thank you. It was my pleasure.
This is Janice Russell, host of People Power, profiling people and organizations making a positive difference in our community and our world. I just spoke with Tad Parson, the executive director of the City Heights Partnership for Children. You can learn more by visiting www.chpfc.org for more information.
You're listening to East County Magazine Show on KNSJ 89.1 FM, Descanso.
This is Miriam Raftery with some tips for college students from the Federal Bureau of Investigation. The FBI has issued a warning for college students traveling abroad to be wary of efforts by foreigners to recruit students for espionage. The FBI has released a video called Game of Pawns, the Glenn Duffy Shriver Story, to educate students traveling overseas about the espionage threat. 3 years ago, Glenn Duffy Shriver, a Michigan resident and former college student who had studied in the People's Republic of China, was sentenced to federal prison in the U.S. for attempting to provide national defense information to Chinese intelligence officers. Over 280,000 American students studied abroad last year. These experiences provide students with cultural opportunities and can equip them with specialized language, technical and leadership skills that make them very marketable to U.S. private industry and government employers. But this same marketability makes these students tempting and vulnerable targets for recruitment by foreign intelligence officers whose long-term goal is to gain access to sensitive or classified U.S. information. The Game of Pawns video dramatizes the steps taken by intelligence officers to recruit Shriver and convince him to apply for jobs with the U.S. State Department and the Central Intelligence Agency, the CIA. The FBI urges American students traveling overseas to view this video before you leave the U.S. so that you're able to recognize if you're being targeted or recruited. So just how do foreign intelligence officers routinely interact with students? First off, they don't normally say that they work for intelligence services when they develop relationships with students. They will claim other lines of work. Intelligence officers then develop relationships with students under seemingly harmless pretexts, such as job or internships opportunities, paid paper writing engagements, language exchanges, and cultural immersion programs. As the relationships develop, a student might be asked to perform a task and provide information, not even sensitive or classified information necessarily, in exchange for payment or other rewards. But over time, these demands grow. Intelligence officers might suggest that students, after finishing up their schooling, apply for U.S. government jobs, especially national security-related agencies. So how can students protect themselves if you're studying abroad? First, be skeptical of money-for-nothing offers and other opportunities that seem too good to be true. And be cautious of being offered free favors, especially any that involve government processes such as obtaining visas, residence permits, and work papers. Minimize personal information that you reveal about yourself, especially on social media. Minimize your contact with people who have questionable government affiliations or anyone you suspect might be engaged in criminal activity, of course. Properly report any money or compensation you receive while abroad on tax forms and other financial disclosure documents to assure compliance with U.S. laws. When you return to the United States, report any suspicious activity to your local FBI office, or you can contact your local U.S. embassy or consulate while you're abroad. Glenn Duffy Shriver issued this warning to other students not to do what he has done.
The motivation behind it was definitely greed and money. You know, when you're having money thrown at you, especially when you're in a place like Shanghai, it's a hard tap to turn off. They say everyone has their price. And, you know, when you're being told, hey, you don't have to do anything about it. We just want to be your friends. Here's $10,000, no big deal. It's hard to say no to. But recruitment's going on, you know. Don't fool yourself. The recruitment is active. And the target is young people. Throw lots of money at them. See what happens. But through the time, they kept telling me, hey, you know, we don't want anything illegal from you. You know, we're not asking anything illegal, you know. At the same time, they were telling me, hey, maybe it would be best not to talk about, you know, us meeting with each other, things like that. Once they've got you on video taking that money, whatever happens is they've got you, you know. There's no going back from that.
Shriver was first asked to write political papers, then developed a friendship with others who suggested he apply for U.S. government jobs.
Eventually, he did realize they worked for the Chinese government, but he still took $70,000 in exchange for applying for jobs until he got arrested. He pled guilty and was sentenced to 4 years in prison. And, of course, if someone actually succeeds at passing along classified secrets, you could go to jail for much longer, in prison perhaps for the rest of your life, for treason. Shriver admitted in court that his ultimate objective was to get a job with a U.S. government agency that would give him access to classified information, which he would then provide to the Chinese officers in return for cash payments. Now, to a recent college graduate, $70,000 seems like a lot of money, and the promise of even more was just too tempting for Shriver to pass up. But what he didn't consider were the long-term costs of his actions, which included throwing away his education, his career, and his future by becoming a spy for China. You can view the video and get more tips on how to protect yourself when traveling out of the country on the FBI website at www.fbi.gov. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Miriam Raftery. This is a public service announcement from the nonprofit East County Magazine regarding the Viejas Wildfire and Emergency Alert Service. During a wildfire, it's critical to receive timely news about evacuations, shelters, threatened communities, and other vital information. Viejas Wildfire and Emergency Alerts are available free to the public via email, or you can receive the alerts via Twitter on your mobile phone. You can get information on how to sign up for these free alerts at www.eastcountymagazine.org. The Viejas Wildfire and Emergency Alerts are produced by East County Magazine with support from the Viejas Band of the Kumeyaay Nation.
This is Leon Thompson with news about the latest bold tactics being used by international drug smugglers. Drug smugglers have been using ultralight aircraft to smuggle narcotics over the border. The U.S. Border Patrol asks the public to report sightings of suspicious ultralight aircraft. An ultralight aircraft sounds like a motorcycle and may be spotted 24 hours a day, but often operate at night. If you see one along our international border, the U.S. Border Patrol asks that you report it by calling 619-498-9900.
This concludes today's episode of East County Magazine's radio show. We extend our appreciation to the San Diego Performance Academy for the use of their studio, to the Heartland Coalition, our parent nonprofit, and to KNSJ 89.1 FM, broadcasting from the heart of East County in Descanso. We also thank the musicians who provided music for our show, Laura Preble, Jim Hannibal, Corey Clement, Giovanni Galicia and the Smashing Beats, Donnie Gentile, Wooden Ambulance, Dusty Summer Road, A.K. Jules, Brian Boykel, Royalty Free Music, Frank Nora, Kevin McLeod, April's Dance from the Smart Sound Solo Simplicity Collection, and Turco, Nomads of the Silk Road. We also thank the County of San Diego for a community enhancement grant to support our Destination East County segment. If you have story ideas or would like to underwrite the East County Magazine radio show, please contact editor@eastcountymagazine.org or call 619-698-7617. We'll be back soon for another edition of East County Magazine's radio show.